All right, you guys, welcome back to the show from yesterday. Yeah, I always do that, don't I? I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Thanks very much to Ernie Hancock for having me on his show earlier. If you didn't hear it, you're about to hear me say pretty much all the same stuff again, I guess. Also, I've got Eric Garris is coming on to talk about the new war. Garris doesn't do enough radio, man. I'm trying to get him to do some more radio. So that'd be good. And then remember I kept recommending to you this article, The Rise of ISIS by Waleed Farwana. We published it at antiwar.com. And boy, I better pull it up here because he's going to be on the show to talk about that article today. And that should be a good one too. The Rise of ISIS... anti-war, ta-da, and that is, boy, there are a lot of different articles with that name at antiwar.com. Let me add Waleed here. All right, yeah, Waleed Farwana is, oh, he spells his name different ways, I can't keep track. He's going to be on the show to talk about the rise of the Islamic State. Who are these kooks, where they come from? What's this goddamn big deal? And I got more invites out. I don't know what's going to happen. But I'll tell you this. I'm really bummed out. I don't know how to stop a war. You regular listeners to the show know that I've been, this whole time. For many, many months. For more than a year, I've been saying that support, well, hell, probably for the whole 3 years. Support for the Mujahideen in Syria just means that eventually we'll have to go back to fight them again. And, you know, after all this time, I guess I've learned a lot about all the different wars. I haven't learned a damn thing about how to stop a war. And really, I haven't learned a damn thing about getting the truth through to the American people. Now, I read this morning an article by Dan Frumkin over at The Intercept where he's quoting these different media sources, and these congressmen are leaking all of this stuff about there are ISIS sleeper cells all over America, and they're going to all sneak across the Mexican border, even though nobody explained how Mexico's full of these guys in the first place or anything like that. Never mind. And something even about, well, let me get a footnote for this because this is the craziest, stupidest one of them of all. Let me see here. Well, I'll paraphrase it for now to fill the dead air. Something about spraying Ebola on you. Oh, they're going to give you Ebola. And, all right, fine. Control F, Ebola. Where the hell is it? All right, here. Oh, yeah, see, no, it's somebody else paraphrasing Mr. Benjamin, Daniel Benjamin, who served as the State Department's top counterterrorism advisor during Obama's first term, said the public discussion about the ISIS threat has been a farce, with members of the cabinet and top military officials all over the place describing the threat in lurid terms that are not justified. Not congressmen, administration people he's accusing here. Former top counterterrorism advisor in the first Obama term. And then he goes on to say, it's hard to imagine a better indication of the ability of elected officials and TV talking heads to spin the public into a panic with claims that the nation is honeycombed with sleeper cells, that operatives are streaming across the border into Texas, or that the group will soon be spraying Ebola virus on mass transit systems, all on the basis of no corroborated information, said Mr. Benjamin, who is now a scholar at Dartmouth College. And in fact, this is actually a great write-up of people in the media calling BS right now, which is nice, but again, you know, already still too little too late. But anyway, for the life of me, I can't get how to get people to figure out that, oh yeah, no, everything that they ever said to you before was a lie, and this is also a lie. How could you believe them? I mean, the government is run by a bunch of lawyers, right? That's who's in Congress, a bunch of lawyers, by supermajorities. Lawyers! The worst people in the world! And then we all know that the American system means people who are already powerful and wealthy hire lobbyists to make sure that the government will make sure that they stay powerful and wealthy and have their interests protected and carried out at the rest of our expense. We all already know that. Oh, democracy, this and that. The sanctity of the religion of the American state, please. We all know. They lied us into every war. Why would you think that they mean it when they say that there are a bunch of terrorists in Mexico who can't wait to come here and spray Ebola on you? And I'm sorry, I know it ain't you. It's your Uncle Bob and your brother-in-law and whoever, right? It's everybody but the person I'm yelling at. But I can't understand it, seriously. Don't you remember how they lied you into war before with Iraq? Before? They said they were a terrorist threat. A chemical and biological weapons threat. They could spray you. Remember with UAVs, they were going to spray you with germs and chemical weapons, claimed George Bush in his Cincinnati speech in October of 2002. And it wasn't true. But anyway, so now you've got a proto-state, in a sense. Like, I don't want to sell these guys short or sell the argument short of who the Islamic State is. It's Al-Qaeda in Iraq, Zarqawi's old group, all grown up as hell. And yet still, I saw it today, there are estimates that say they have as many as $2 billion in their terrorist treasury. Oh, really, huh? They got 15,000 fighters. Every attack is the same thing. A couple of suicide bombers, and then some blitzkrieg with the Toyotas and machine guns. And then they hire locals to stand in their place as they move on to the next one. They may want to be Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge, but they're not even as advanced as the Khmer Rouge was. And they were just a bunch of bark-eating crazies. With jungle cover, you know, these guys, I believe, and I'm sorry for any part I played. I don't think I really have, because I've disclaimed to the high heavens about it. I'm not fear-mongering or war-mongering why to go and strike these guys in Iraq. I'm fear-mongering why not to. I think that they are a threat. I have zero faith in the FBI or the federal police or intelligence agencies of this country or our Western European allied countries, NATO countries, including Turkey, to keep these guys out of the United States. I have no faith in them whatsoever. You know what I have faith in the FBI to do? Entrap some idiot into saying he loves Osama so they can give him 35 years. That's easy. But actually protect the American people? FBI, CIA, NSA? Today's the anniversary of good luck with that. And I believe that it may not be ISIS's strategy. I don't know. I got in an interesting argument with Lande about this, but it's certainly still Al-Qaeda's strategy to try to keep America fighting in the sands of Mesopotamia. And in fact, do I have enough time to say this? Yeah. Right now, we're playing directly into Al-Qaeda's hands, maybe even more than ISIS. Because ISIS is saying to Al-Qaeda, you guys are idiots, we want to declare a state now. Osama and Zawahiri always said, no, we have to bleed the far enemy to bankruptcy first, force the American empire out. Only then will we be able to overthrow the local governments. Otherwise, the Americans will always back them up and or intervene directly. And here Obama is, just like George W. Bush before him, he is playing out Osama bin Laden's script perfectly. That, see, we told you, you gotta keep fighting the Americans until they keep fighting us so bad, and they're collectivists, they're willing to get innocents killed in the thing, until we're bankrupt enough we finally bug all the way out. It's pretty simple, right? Hey, all, Scott Horton here. I want to tell you about this great new book, Livin' La Vida Baroka, American Culture in an Age of Imperial Orthodoxies by Thomas Harrington. While he comes from the left, Harrington has little time for much of what is passed off under that label today. Like us libertarians, he puts peace and freedom first. The book's got great essays on American fascism, empire, the Israeli occupation, the left and Obama, liberalism in the state, and some interesting lessons from the history of Imperial Spain. Live in La Vida Baroca by Thomas Harrington. Check it out at scotthorton.org/books or scotthorton.org/Amazon.
I am standing here beside myself, man. I just don't know. The fact that we're going back to war in Iraq is what it is. But the fact that Obama's proclaimed strategy is to continue to back the rebels in Syria? Let me tell you who's the rebels in Syria. ISIS. I mean, it is an absolute fact that guys who were trained by the United States have gone over to ISIS. And it is an absolute fact that ISIS is using weapons that America supplied. Hell, Public Radio International had a whole story about those fleets of Toyota trucks. Where do you think those came from? That's America's non-lethal aid to the rebels. Those were the trucks that ISIS used for the sacking of Mosul. And Tikrit. And, you know, the rest of their war, the creation of their caliphate. Made in USA. Report shows ISIS using arms from Syria rebels. In this case, again, TOW missiles. Haven't I been telling you this all along? It was on Blogs of War. The Islamic Front, which included Ahrar al-Sham, that Prothero says those are the guys that the Saudis were financing the most. The guys that got their entire leadership suicide bombed the other day by ISIS. But anyway, they were basically serving as really just the procurement arm for the al-Nusra Front, which is the local al-Qaeda affiliate that ISIS split off from, and they're getting these TOW missiles from the CIA in Jordan, getting trained on them, and then they're going and fighting side by side in battle with Nusra. Guess what? Weapons and CIA dollars are fungible. And so, and you know what? I'm sorry for hurting your ears if you're a regular listener to this show, but the rest of America ain't catching on yet. Certainly not in the media. As I've been saying this whole time, the moderates ain't fighting. Moderates don't fight. Moderates means big fat expats who work for the CIA and sit at fancy hotels in Doha and can't wait for America to hand them power on a silver platter. That's who moderates are. The guys who are out there doing the fighting are not moderates. Now, look, some of them are not outright hardcore bin Ladenites, but whatever. Those people are the remainder. Those people are superfluous. This fight has always been, since 2011, al-Nusra's fight. And then again, ISIS just broke off from al-Nusra and said, instead of doing what Zawahiri says, we want to do what we want and hurry up and declare a caliphate now. And so this whole time, America has been helping and, you know, coordinating, leading the effort, and helping the Saudis, the Qataris, the Turks, and they say the Kuwaitis too, although I don't know that much about that, but okay, fine, to finance these different rebel groups. But of course, it always ends up, all the best equipment and the resources, the financial resources, end up in the hands of the meanest of the fighters. And so, Obama himself, just last month, the President of the United States explained to Thomas Friedman at the New York Times, in response to Hillary Clinton's criticism of him for not building up this third force of so-called secular rebels over the last few years, in 2011 and 12, 13, when she wanted to do it. He said, look, the idea we're going to just get a bunch of regular Joe Syrian guys to form an army and train them up to where they're going to be able to defeat a state army of Syria that's backed by Iran and Hezbollah and Russia, was a fantasy. And of course, it's still a fantasy. Only now he wants this third force. He's claiming its priority, the same third force, will be to fight ISIS. And then what? They're going to turn around. They're going to get to Assad later. It's crazy. And again, for the 1 millionth time, I'm not saying the U.S. should be backing Assad against these guys. But we absolutely, the U.S. government absolutely should not have been backing them against him since 2011. And they sure as hell should not be doubling down on the bet and saying more money and more guns for the rebels in Syria, the third force of moderates that doesn't exist. Richard Engel from NBC News went off about this last night. Believe that. Saying what moderates? What? Ow, I kind of bit my cheek there. What moderates? What third force? What in the world are you talking about? There is a force in Syria that is the enemy of, well, there are two forces in Syria that are actual enemies with worthy fighters of ISIS, worthy enemies of ISIS with that have worthy fighters that can fight. And that is al-Nusra, that is loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri, the butcher of New York, and Bashar al-Assad and his state army. Yeah, it's absolutely crazy. And what's funny, too, is if you really wanted to go back through the archives, you could find conversations on this show. Probably just search, you know, by year and by keyword Syria and find discussion. I remember talking with Lou Rockwell back in probably 2004, maybe 2005, and Lou saying, yeah, and now these kooks want to go to Syria, the last country in the Middle East where you can get a drink. And they want to overthrow the secular government there and replace it with what? This is the question I've been asked. I swear, the particular pattern in my vocal cords is sore from saying for a decade. What? You want to overthrow Assad in Syria? But who could possibly be a better government in Syria from the point of view of the Israelis and the neocons, the ones behind this policy? Who do you think you're going to get that's kinder to Israel than Assad? The Muslim Brotherhood, if you're lucky. You know, one day Google will be able to search MP3s for, you know, text words, right? They're working on that. One day you'll be able to just Google the MP3 by typing in the text. The Muslim Brotherhood, if you're lucky, quote unquote. Scott Horton for the last 10 years. Otherwise, it's going to be, what, the Sunni-based insurgency from Iraq come back to Syria. Madness and chaos. David Wurmser said in Coping with Crumbling States, yes, what we want to do is expedite the chaotic collapse. That way we can better control the future circumstances. Oh, yeah, huh? Expedite the chaotic collapse in order to lead to what again? And here, Bashar al-Assad is like, might as well have been created in an Israeli laboratory. He hadn't made a peep about the Golan Heights this whole time. He's no threat at all. I mean, he backs Hezbollah, but so what? All they are is a defensive threat, if that's even a term. That's an oxymoron itself. Whole thing's crazy. Whole thing's crazy. I mean, I could have seen Obama say, I mean, I guess he doesn't have to say it this way, but if the policy really was tilt back toward Assad, that would at least make sense. It would be evil and it'd be counterproductive. At least on the face of it, it would make sense. But this doesn't even make any sense on its face. Back in the moderates. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X Keyscore, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betrayed their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy. The OffNow project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something. Something important. Something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Online, I got Eric Garris. He's the founder and managing director of antiwar.com. Write about everything for 19 years and counting now. Welcome back to the show. Eric, how are you doing?
Great. How are you doing, Scott?
I'm doing pretty good. Well, so the president declared war again. He keeps doing this every couple of weeks. He announces we're going to war with Iraq again, everybody. Okay. But now, so I guess last night supposedly was the big one. What do we learn any different than what we already knew about what America's doing over there?
Well, we didn't really learn anything from Obama's speech. It was, he had a lot of wiggle room, and he's basically asking for or declaring that he has the right to do whatever he wants in Iraq, Syria, and anywhere else that he sees ISIS.
Mm-hmm. So was he, it's interesting, I don't know if this has been made clear in the journalism yet, was he referring back to the original AUMF after September 11th at that point? Or he's just saying, I don't need any authorization to use force, I can kill anybody that I say is a terrorist, or what?
Well, maybe I missed it, but I didn't really hear any legal justification for how he's declaring that he has this power, other than it is to protect America.
Right, yeah. Sounds like he's just saying he has that authority. He doesn't need any other authority at all, even the one passed after September 11th with all the... They've rewritten it to include associated forces and all this other stuff, but I guess he's not even invoking that, just like Dick Cheney... exactly 13 years ago, he's decided the unitary executive is all. Not too big of a surprise, I guess.
Well, and regarding Syria specifically, he did not announce what he's going to do, but he essentially saying he reserves the right to go into Syria and do whatever he wants without anybody's consent.
Well, now, what's Congress saying about that? Is there much pushback at all?
Well, I've heard a little bit. There are several members of Congress who are demanding that Congress be consulted at the very least. Unfortunately, people are ignoring what the Constitution says, which is that Congress has the power to declare war, and nobody is asking for a declaration of war other than some of the more constitutionalist fringe of Congress.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. At best, it'll be an authorization if they even vote on it. But at least...
Well, what he's proposing is to ask permission to arm the Syria rebels, which he's already been doing for quite a while now. And if he gets that, assuming that they just give it to him as he asked for... He's then going to use that as a slippery slope to support the Syria rebels with airstrikes to help them use those weapons. But keep in mind that when he says the Syria rebels, as I know you've been talking about already on the show, he is talking about people who are an ISIS-like.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Patrick Coburn has said on this show, and it's in his new book, too, that when he goes and talks with the FSA guys, there's no difference between them, al-Nusra, and ISIS, other than maybe these guys have decided they don't mind cozying up to America for some money and weapons a little bit more. But otherwise, they all have the exact same agenda. The only differences between them are, who's who. Who gets to call the shots and who has to follow the orders.
Right. They have some minor... strategical and tactical differences, but their ideologies are very similar. The Free Syrian Army, one of their factions is the group that sold Sotloff to ISIS.
Right. Yeah, and of course, you know, the Farouk Brigade, I don't know if they're even around anymore, but they had been cited for a long time as being one of the moderate groups because they were for elections and for, you know, some form of secularism. And, you know, they fell short of calling for the complete annihilation of everybody who's not Sunni Arab in Syria, which has been the ISIS and al-Nusra, tactic, basically. But then, so, oh, good, they're moderate and secular and won elections. But it was their commander was the cannibal eating the dead soldier's heart on video that went viral around the world. These are our moderates.
And Obama, a few weeks ago, in his interview with Thomas Friedman in the New York Times, said that the idea of finding moderate rebels to arm in Syria was a fantasy. Yet, almost the very next day, he called for more arms to them. And I don't understand exactly what he thinks he is going to do. He's going to be arming ISIS and bombing them at the same time.
Yeah, it's really crazy. And I understand that he's in a weird predicament where here he's been guilty of high treason for 3 years straight now, directly, well, barely indirectly. I say, you know, it's a gray area, but pretty much directly supporting this Mujahideen war against Assad this whole time. And now he's got to pivot. And so now it's just a question of language, right? He needs every O'Brien in the entire Ministry of Truth to try to figure out a way to spin the pivot back to Assad, or at least against the rebels he's been supporting all along. And he doesn't quite know how to do it. I mean,
right.
If he was going to be honest at all, he would just say, all right, fine, we're going to do like Bill Clinton and George W. Bush, and we're going to pay Assad to kill these guys and to reestablish his army's monopoly on force in the land known as Syria. But that's not the policy, and apparently it can't be.
Well, not only that, okay, taking a step back, not as a non-interventionist, but just looking at what he is trying to do, mm-hmm. he should, from his point of view, make up with Assad. Assad really has no problems with the U.S. Assad participated in rendition and torture with the United States for 15 years, and he would be perfectly happy to join up with the U.S. to fight against ISIS. But the only thing holding Obama back there is Israel's insistence that we have to be for regime change in Syria.
Right. Absolutely. Although, you know, at this point now, I mean, really, if they had just stayed out of the war altogether in 2011 and 12, Assad would have been finished winning by then. It would have all been over. But, you know, I took it real seriously when I saw Michael Scheuer on TV. And for those not familiar, Michael Scheuer, former chief of the CIA's Bin Laden unit, no love for Israel and their policy against Assad whatsoever. He would be, all things being equal, he would be all for having Assad kill each and every last one of these guys and anybody nearby him. Anybody who's ever heard Scheuer talk about this kind of stuff knows that. And yet he told Fox News, Lou Dobbs on Fox News, he said, we should not back Assad now because that just reinforces the entire narrative of our enemies, that we are on the side of the Iranian Shia and their proxies. They're trying to make this a massive regional sectarian civil war. We've already really made it that way with our invasion of Iraq back in 2003. And to side with the Shia now is just as counterproductive as, you know, just going in there and carpet bombing them.
Well, this is what's crazy, because the analysts, his own people, are telling him the truth about what's going on in Syria, and then they ignore that and turn around and they pretend that they can arm some group, some non-existent group of people that have the ability to win in Syria and who are not Islamists and who are not Assad. They don't exist. There is nobody like that in Syria. Syria has over 1,500 different Islamist groups. And the only fight, if Assad goes, the only fighting that's going to be going on is between these 1,500, among these 1,500 groups.
Yep. Well, now, and you know, Roy Gutman from McClatchy, he did a report last week about how he talked with all the FSA leaders, the Free Syrian Army. They're not moderates, but those are the American-backed guys. And how they've been completely cut out of the loop. And the CIA is now directly working with the FSA groups on the ground, which are these, again, tiny little militia groups. And there are, you know, whatever, a dozen or so working directly for the CIA. But that amounts to nothing. As Landay says, they amount to basically the border guards keeping these guys out of Jordan and Israel. We'll be right back with Eric Garrison in just a sec. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. It's libertarian foreign policy, mostly. Talking with Eric Garris, founder and director of antiwar.com. And we're talking about Obama's big speech last night and the announcement of the same damn policy here of, well, seemingly just making matters worse and worse. I wonder about, Eric, when you think about the last Iraq war, which was fought de facto for Iran in the sense of putting their favored groups among the Shiite majority in power in Baghdad and kicking all the Sunnis out of Baghdad for them at power drill point and all of that. In this case, because we don't have all the Army and Marine Corps on the ground, the Iranians can't use our Army and Marine Corps on the ground. So instead, it's their guys on the ground. The Quds Force is already there leading and helped with the America and Iran really work together with the so-called liberation of that town in Milri, or however you say it there, where the Turkmen were. And it seems like, just like in Schroeder's warning about Syria there, that by really doing anything here at all, we are outright allying with Iran in such a way as to really probably energize many, many more people to ISIS's cause. And of course, you and me and antiwar.com and everything, we're 100% good on the getting along with Iran issue, but that doesn't mean we want to have a military alliance with them, and especially when it's a revolutionary Shiite government that rules the country, a theocracy that rules the country. It's not like they're just the Shiites next door. They are a Shiite government, revolutionary movement in charge over there. And we are outright more than ever aligning with them against the Sunnis of Iraq. And that to me just seems like a recipe for total catastrophe here. There's no one good to ally with.
Well, that's true. Congressman Jim Moran said last night after the speech that Obama is turning us into the Shiite Air Force, and that is just going to make Sunnis more and more angry with us. And it's not just a question of building ISIS. It's also a question of uniting the other Sunni tribes and the Sunni militias with ISIS to fight against us and the Shiites and just create a much worse situation. You know, I wanted to mention Libya, because Libya is a really good example of what is going to happen to Syria, although Syria is going to be much worse if Assad falls. In Libya now, you have essentially three countries developing. You have two different governments, both of them elected in the West, that are competing with each other. And then you have a more extreme al-Qaeda-type Islamist group controlling the East in Benghazi. And then you have this General Hifter, who has clearly been a CIA asset for many, many years. He lived in D.C. for 20 years. He's got the Libyan Air Force, and he is bombing the more radical Islamists. But what he wants, neither of the governments really want him, because what he wants is the military coup. We left Libya in a situation where it's worse than a failed state.
Yeah, it's just tearing itself apart. And, of course, it's another one of these fake countries that was being held together by the dictator. But, of course, what was his only virtue, really, Gaddafi, was killing al-Qaeda guys, keeping them at least from doing exactly what Obama helped them do. And, you know, this has actually always been puzzling to me, because if you remember back when we talked in 2011 about this, I was always scaremongering about how this means we are going to have to occupy Libya, and we're going to have to create a new democracy, we're going to have to train up their army, we're going to hold purple-fingered elections, which they actually did the purple-fingered elections, but this is going to be another break-it-you-own-it kind of thing, because once they overthrow Gaddafi, there will be nothing left of his state, which hardly existed at all in the first place. It was just him and his Gestapo. So once we got rid of it, then what? And so I just assume that it'll mean total occupation. But apparently the plan was no plan, right? I mean, in Iraq, they occupied the place with no real plan about what the hell they were trying to do. In Libya, they got rid of Gaddafi. We came, we saw, he died, ha ha ha. And then It was like it didn't exist. And I'm not complaining that they didn't invade the place, but it's kind of strange to me. It was like they never had another meeting about Libya in the White House again after that or something. I don't know how they decided to do that or how they decided to just let it be.
Well, and they seem to have the same plan for Syria. I mean, they do not... nation building in Syria would be would make Libya look like a cakewalk. I mean, there's no way that with Assad gone, that we are going to be able to do anything but bomb various factions and arm various factions, which are just going to make turn it more and more into a chaotic situation.
Right, which is the same thing that we've been saying about Syria since Libya. Which is, hey, in Libya, at least it's a pretty simple east-to-west direction, sparsely populated territory, special forces on the ground, NATO in the air. You help these guys sack that city, and you're done. And so it'll happen eventually. It took them 9 months to do it, but we never doubted that eventually they'll sack Tripoli. But in Syria, from 2011 on, we said it's going to be an entirely different process there. Yeah, way more complicated situation. You don't have the simple geographic move from one side of the country to the other kind of a situation at all. And they're not going to be able to put a bunch of special forces on the ground and NATO planes in the air because Assad has Russian air defenses. And so they can't do, you know, the no-fly zone trick and all of that. You know, they were basically embarking on the same policy, only without any of the things that made Libya doable, even in that narrow sense, you know?
Right. Well, we have what's happening now. We are looking at a sea change for the Middle East. We're not just talking about changing borders. The whole idea of what makes up a country in the Middle East is going to be thrown out the window. We are turning it back pre-World War I into warring tribes and empires. And it's just going to be, it's going to be insane. It's going to be, we're not even going to be able to predict what the results of what we're doing are. We're probably going to see is a World War III, not necessarily a nuclear World War III, but an extremely chaotic world situation that could go on for decades and decades.
Yep. Yeah, there's just no doubt about it. And, you know, even if you argued all things being equal and Obama never did back the rebellions in Libya and Syria, still, just the fact that George Bush fought to give Baghdad to the Shia means that X number of Sunnis will never accept that. And we'll fight till one day they have it back. And that could be decades and decades or longer. But that's a lot of blood to be spilled.
And what you have is you have the Israelis who want this to be simply about Shia versus Sunni, and they want to be pro-Sunni. Michael Oren, the former U.S. Israeli ambassador to the U.S., said a few weeks ago that that's what this is about, Sunni versus Shia. And Israel is on the side of the Sunnis over Shia.
Right. And even though the Sunnis are Al-Qaeda, the suicide bombers, the berserkers, the lunatics, and the Shia are Hezbollah, who are like tame pets compared to Al-Qaeda, who don't do a thing except sit on the northern side of the line all day up there. So not only did he say that, but he and Netanyahu he serves must be absolutely out of their minds.
They are. It makes no sense. They are so arrogant that they cannot see the reality of what's in front of them.
Yeah. And by the way, the Google keywords for that are Michael Oren, Sunnis, Aspen. And I'll be playing that clip. I have a clip of Hillary Clinton I want to play on the other side of this break for you guys, too. But that is absolutely the Israeli thinking. And that's why, in fact, I've been kind of joking darkly, Eric, that it's actually kind of a silver lining that Washington, D.C. is so caught up in their treason for Israel and doing what Israel wants in opposing Assad. It's taken them that much longer to turn their ship around and redirect back toward the Shia and against the Sunnis again. We could have had a full-scale, hardcore, blitzkrieg type of war against the Islamic State going on for the last 2 months. They're still trying to work out their narrative to explain their treason the last 3 years, thanks to Israel. So it's going to slow things down. I don't know. Anyway, man, I wanted to ask you about the politics in Baghdad, too, but that one will have to wait. I talked too much. Thanks so much for talking.
All right. I'd love to come back on soon and talk about the politics of Baghdad.
We will.
They'll probably change by the next time I'm on.
Yeah, it could be tomorrow. All right, thanks. That's Eric Garris, antiwar.com. We'll be right back, y'all. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm here weekdays at noon on the Liberty Radio Network. Full interview archives and whole show archives and the blog and everything else is there at scotthorton.org. And you can follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. Our next guest today is Waleed Farwana. He is an American researcher, writer, and amateur historian currently residing in Chicago, Illinois. And he's written this great article for antiwar.com. We ran it back on, I'll tell you exactly when we ran it. On August the 24th, the history of the Islamic State. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How about you?
I'm doing great. Appreciate you joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. Happy to have you here. And so you wrote this, it seems like every week and a half or so, Obama declares war again. Same thing over and over again. So this was timed with the big supposed rescue of the Yazidis from the mountain kind of thing was the timing for this. But you decided you would go ahead and catch us up on who are these guys and where do they come from? It's a term that people aren't really familiar with, so they kind of wonder whether they really exist at all or what the hell, you know what I mean? So go ahead and... if you want, I don't know, what do you think, start with the war in 2003, or you want to go back before that?
Well, I think it's necessary to look at the Islamic State itself. It's a really creation, as you said, if we go back to 2003, of imperialist policy by the United States that's been going on really since the war in Afghanistan. If you really want to look at really like the primordial roots of something like the Islamic State, you should look at going as far back as Afghanistan. So the haven of jihadists, which was really established in the 1980s to fight Soviet occupation, basically it moved to the West, to Iraq, to fight the American occupation, which is really the great irony of the whole thing in that the United States went to Iraq, to ostensibly fight against Al-Qaeda, which wasn't even there at the time, and what resulted was it got a group even worse than Al-Qaeda to settle in there.
Right. Now, so now when it comes to Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, he was a veteran of the 1980s CIA-supported war against the Russians there, correct?
That's not correct. He actually got there at the tail end of the war in Afghanistan, and he never actually saw combat, if we're to believe the historical recounts of his biography. Yeah.
Well, I read Loretta Napoleone's book, too, and it's great, but it's been, 10 years or something since I read it. So
eight
years or something.
Small detail. I mean, he was a monster. And it wasn't really until he got to Iraq that he started to coordinate strikes against the United States there. In the article that I wrote, I really reference him as really the guy who, with his violence and with this really the sick vision that he had, he really tore a hole through the fabric of not just the Iraqi society, but really the mentality of people in the Middle East as a whole. Like this sort of sectarian violence was around before really this era that we live in today, but it was always a it was always like one of those things that you wouldn't ever really picture everyday people getting violent over. It was something that was seen as sort of like a dirty thing in the Middle East to make these sectarian distinctions. But now they're all out in the open, and it's largely due to these people who, these ideologues who've come into the region and essentially just like provoke this extreme level of violence based on this dream of conquesting fabricated glory in their own minds.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, and Zarqawi, before the war, I have to interject this here. I don't think it's in your article because it's a little bit out of context, but not really. Jim Mikleshevsky at NBC News, and then a lot of other people, surprising number of people, did a surprising amount of journalism, if I remember right about this, if people want to search. And that is about how the army had basically begged George Bush on numerous occasions to attack Zarqawi and his group up in Kurdistan, American-protected autonomous Kurdistan, before the war, because they were just looking at it from the point of view of their army guys. If we can get rid of this guy before the regime change, good deal. We don't want him running around free. This guy's dangerous. They knew it good and well. And I guess actually Lawrence Wilkerson said that part of the reason it was turned down, he told me this, part of the reason it was turned down was because they wanted to go in with such a huge amount of force that it was almost like a deal killer kind of a thing, a poison pill in a way. But in any case, they had every reason to understand that this guy who the propaganda said Saddam was friends with, but actually Saddam had a death warrant out for, that he was really dangerous, and that overthrowing Saddam with him on the loose was going to be a real problem. And then they did it anyway.
Yeah, I think that what your friend told you, Mr. Wilkerson, was probably pretty much on the dot. And I think that the reason why they didn't really go after him was they wanted somebody who they could point at and say, this is the bad guy.
Right. He was all they had, right? He was the only pretended link between Saddam and Osama that they could even pretend to hold up, was that Saddam had given him a peg leg and was, you know, a friend of him and took care of him in the hospital and all this stuff. And even though, as you said, he wasn't even loyal to bin Laden yet either.
Yeah, I mean, it's really just, I really don't like to pay attention to the propaganda that like any wartime figure is going to give, because they have the ends that they want, and they're just trying to justify it. And in my article, I actually write that I think that the case of Zarqawi was that the reason why he rose to such prominence was really because of the free publicity that the United States was giving him by making him their occupation boogeyman. Mm-hmm. So really, if he was one of many jihadists, like-minded jihadists who were operating in Iraq, and it was really the U.S. policy of holding this guy up on a pedestal and really lionizing him as the, you know, vanguard leader of Sunni Iraqi terrorism that really drove people to end up becoming recruits in his organization.
Right. Yeah, at one point the propaganda was so thick where they blamed every single thing that exploded on him in a way where people started wondering whether he really existed at all. It was so obvious that they were lying. But it was because they were trying to make it look like, well, no Iraqis would fight us, right? Only these terrorists who come from elsewhere, somewhere, these foreign fighters, they come in and they resist us because they're terrorists. But, of course, all Iraqis know that we're just doing all this for them and that kind of thing. And, of course, that was a giant lie. The entire Sunni-based insurgency had plenty of their own nationalistic and tribalistic reasons for fighting that the Americans refused to acknowledge. So just like with Osama, they made Zarqawi out to be the Soviet Union or something, you know?
Yeah, exactly. It's, everything you said was spot on. The United States really wanted to manufacture its own version of Iraqi nationalism, really with no input from the actual people on the ground. So, I mean, their policy of really trying to establish this nationalism was they would find some sort of politicians or really anybody willing to accept bribes from them, put them at the seat of power in this U.S.-designed bureaucracy, and really just keep the money flowing so long as they prevented attacks on U.S. occupation troops, so long as they you know, acquiesce to whatever the United States' mission was in Iraq. I still don't even know what the Iraq, what the United States' mission was in Iraq to this day. But as you can see now, I mean, Iraq unraveled as soon as the U.S. pulled out and the money stopped flowing. So it's really a sad tale and a really cynical tale of just shows you, unfortunately, how, you know, really how Machiavellian these people are over there. And the people who are involved in these kinds of conflicts, they really just are only really looking out for themselves. And this whole idea of nationalism and Iraqi unity is just a fantasy.
Right. And, you know, the worst part of this, too, is how obvious it was that they were lying to us for a year and a half straight to get us into that war. And how many people, not just regular people like me, but people like Colleen Rowley and others, warned that what this is going to do for the terrorist movement, to benefit them if we do this. And then they did it anyway. We'll be right back with Waleed Farwana in just a moment. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium. And they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Waleed Farwana. And he wrote this article we ran back in August on the 23rd at antiwar.com. The History of the Islamic State. And that's what we're talking about. It's really the history of Bush's invasion and occupation of Iraq, 2003 through 11 there. And so let's see where we left off. I guess we need to talk about debathification, the abolition of the army, and the basically the complete disintegration of the Iraqi government, as well as the call of Ayatollah Sistani to all the Shia masses to go outside at the beginning of 2004 to call for direct democracy. Forget your caucus system. We're going to do this thing my way, he said, and George Bush cried uncle. And it seemed to me like from that point on, the writing of the Constitution and the purple finger election in January 05, that was all just the window dressing. The stage was set for the full-scale war as soon as Sistani said, we're going to do this my way, not yours. What do you think of that?
I think that Iran had a huge impact on what happened in Iraq, and they're often regarded as, I guess, one of the big winners, quote unquote. I really don't think there's any winner of such a bloodbath, but I think that in part because of, as you said, Iranian instigation, but also because of the intransigence on the side of the Sunnis, where they were essentially willing to fight to establish a border between themselves and the Shiites. That's really what precipitated a extremely bloody civil war, the kind that we're seeing in Syria right now and the kind that we saw in Libya a couple of years back. And I think the Iranians, they sized up the U.S. occupation. They thought that they could take it on, and they did that. They did exactly that. They started arming the militias that they wanted to arm. And really, those militias, particularly the one by Muqtada al-Sadr, the Mahdi army, it still stands to this day. And it's the Iranians are a huge influence on what's going on in Iraq right now, and they really can't be underestimated.
And then, and it was the Mahdi army as well as the Badr brigades that really played right into Zarqawi's game in trying to provoke that sectarian civil war. And I think you say in here that he really differed with Osama bin Laden on this, not that bin Laden could do anything about it from hiding in his attic over there in Pakistan, but that bin Laden and Zawahiri, they never really were for the Sunni-Shia civil war in the first place. This was more Zarqawi's idea.
Right. Like I mentioned earlier how the entire idea of sectarianism was perceived as a rather dirty thing. It was like as crude as playing race, like race baiting in the United States is today. Mm-hmm. But things have spiraled out of control to such an extent where it became a possibility to realistically do that. And Zarqawi, the reason why I consider him a unique figure is because he had a pretty radical vision for how he wanted to transform Iraq. I compare him to essentially the communists in Russia. It was really a Islamic revolution inside of Iraq and inside of Syria that's going on right now. And people don't, for whatever reason, they don't really seem to see the parallels. But it is really a restructuring of the society. It's an erasure of the traditional borders. And it's a reestablishment of new borders on sectarian lines. And I don't think bin Laden had this vision. He didn't have this radical of a vision. He thought that he would establish some sort of Islamic entity, but he wasn't really on the ground to see the obstacles to like the establishment of said entity. He didn't realize that he would have competition with other clerics, particularly Shiite clerics. He thought that the only real competition in the way of his goal was U.S. occupation. And he also didn't really view nationalism as an inherent evil or an inherent obstacle to his goals. He thought that he could continue the existing state structures while basically forming a sort of loose federation of Islamic states kind of centered around his leadership in Afghanistan/Pakistan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that was part of what ISIS said, and I'm skipping ahead in the story here, but they mocked Zarqawi for even saying, go back to Iraq. They said, what's Iraq? What are you talking about, man? There's no border here. Just because some right. Frenchmen drew it. Look, everybody, Zawahiri's for French borders, right? Call them out.
Right. I mean, that's really what triggered the split, is that between Al-Qaeda and ISIS, is that one has had radically different visions. And as I mentioned in the article, Zarqawi and Al-Qaeda merged in 2004, 2005, and they basically became a satellite for Al-Qaeda in Iraq. But as the Syrian war started, really this like these protégés of Zarqawi more or less began to realize that they had a realistic opportunity of establishing his vision, or the vision of these transnational jihadists,
right?
And erasing that line between Iraq and Syria, and if they have their way, really throughout the rest of the region, and probably even beyond that. And I don't say that to scare anybody, but these people really do have a vision of establishing a very large caliphate, the scale of really one of the ancient caliphates. And if you take into regard the speed with which they've taken over Iraq and large parts of Syria, it seems like it's a realistic possibility. That's why it scares a lot of people too.
Yeah, well, I'm not so sure about that.
Said, I mean, they don't recognize the state boundaries. They have their own agenda. They have their own ideology. And they really see this as a huge turf war with every other state in the world, really.
Yeah.
And that's what they see the lines as. They see those borders as just foreign imposed turf lines.
Yeah, which is, of course, true, which is why it's been easy for them to erase those lines in a sense, because, you know, it always was an eggshell on the wall, and George Bush pushed it off, the Humpty Dumpty kind of analogy there. And so it seems to me like they've seized about as much land as they're going to be able to. They're really hemmed in on all sides by enemies now, and they don't have that much money or manpower. But they certainly are as fanatical as you describe them, no doubt about that, always have been. And in fact, and let's get back, because I'm keeping you up for the whole hour. I'm keeping them for the whole hour, everybody. We're about to have to go here in just a second anyway. But yeah, when we get back, I want to ask you about, where'd he go? In just a moment, when we get back, he'll be here in just a minute. I'm going to ask him about when they declared an Islamic state back in, 2006, something like that. I think after Zarqawi died, they tried to declare a state, and that didn't work out so well. And we'll be talking about tribal and jihadi politics with Waleed Farwana, the author of this article, The History of the Islamic State, at antiwar.com. It ran back on August the 23rd, The History of the Islamic State by Waleed Farwana. And also go to my Twitter, scotthorton.org. No, Twitter/Scott Horton Show, and you can find his Twitter handle on there too. All right, be right back. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. Coming up this October 18th at Columbia University in New York, the Future Freedom Foundation is hosting a conference titled Stop the Wars on Drugs and Terrorism, featuring Glenn Greenwald, Radley Balco, Jeremy Scahill, Eugene Jarecki, Jonathan Turley, and others. The event is free and open to the public, but registration is required. Just head over to fff.org to sign up. That's the Stop the Wars on Drugs and Terrorism Conference, Saturday, October 18th, 2014 at Columbia University, sponsored by the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And I'm continuing this conversation with Waleed Farwana. He wrote this article, The History of the Islamic State, for antiwar.com back in August. And so we're talking really about the Iraq Civil War and how Al-Qaeda in Iraq, Zarqawi's group, grew up then. And so this is, I guess, where we talk about the Sunnis losing the Civil War and the Awakening Movement and the death of Zarqawi. And but I wanted to ask you, I guess, where exactly in that timeline, right around circa 2006, where did they declare, at what point did they change the name or try the first time to change the name from Al-Qaeda in Iraq to the Islamic State of Iraq? Because I remember it was kind of met with guffaws then. It was kind of delusions of grandeur for them to name their group that. And but what was exactly the circumstance there?
They didn't turn it to Islamic State. Maybe my history is a bit off here.
Wait, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I screwed up and forgot to hit your dang button. So please start over.
Sorry, I just...
Oh, no, it's my fault. I totally screwed up all the time. I do it all the time. I hadn't hit your button and turned on your audio yet. So anyway.
Oh, okay.
Just the question was, what was the context of that where they tried to change the name the first time?
I think my history is a bit off because we're getting to the minutia here. But I think it was after one of their leaders had been killed, and the idea of the Islamic State in Iraq was really just a continuation of Zarqawi's vision, and really the Al-Qaeda goal of establishing a purely Islamic state along the lines of the Salafi ideology. And for your viewers who don't know what that is, what's called the Salafi ideology is really this puritanical form of Islam, which advocates for this return to the lifestyle of the Prophet Muhammad. And this is a man who lived in 7th century Arabia, so you can only imagine not how insane this idea is,
right,
but how insane the people who adhere to this idea must be.
And only America can make it seem like some kind of plausible solution to what, you know, their lives are like. But anyway.
Yeah, so at the same time, really what this movement into Iraq and this establishment of an Islamic state in Iraq, it really came in tandem with this weakness in the Iraqi society itself, and this key division that I don't think that the United States really accounted for in its pre-war invasion. They thought that they could go in and just play this purely on sectarian lines, but there is this tribal element within the Arab society and particularly within the Iraqi society, which is really pronounced for various historical reasons, which I won't go into. But what Zarqawi's people did after his death and with the establishment of this Islamic state is they really went after this tribal system and as a method for getting recruits. They had this problem with legitimacy in Iraq, where they were viewed as foreigners, troublemakers, people who would come to Iraq basically to opportunists, people who'd come to Iraq basically to take advantage of this chaos and this carnage. And they had a real big PR problem there. They needed to make it seem like they were supported on the ground by the locals. And they found people within this Iraqi tribal system who would end up supporting them. And the reason for this is this tribal system is it's basically a pyramid structure where there is a small group of of males who really dominate the entire structure. And this is a pretty large structure we're talking about here, which comprises millions of people within Iraq. And it's essentially like a king, like a monarchy in and of itself. So as you can imagine, the people at the bottom of this pyramid really don't get much, and they don't really benefit from this tribal system at all. It ends up creating a large incentive for the people at the bottom of the structure, particularly disaffected men, to join up with organizations like Al-Qaeda or other terrorist groups like that, really so that they can, in their view, really stake a claim in their existence, so they can make something, they can acquire resources however they can, because within their own tribal structure, that's pretty much off limits to them. And this policy of pursuing these lower level tribal members worked for Al-Qaeda, and that's really the substrate of the organization to this day, both in Iraq and in Syria.
Mm-hmm. But then for a time there, the tribes fought back. I guess, you know, I remember, I don't have all my footnotes in order now, but I remember having them assembled back when, say in 2008, about how the Sunnis had been offering pretty much every July in 2003 and all the way through, every summer, they would offer again, please just let us patrol our own neighborhoods, give us a little bit of money and some AKs, and we'll stop fighting your guys. And then so when Petraeus took command in the beginning of 2007, he finally took them up on that offer after they had already lost Baghdad, of course. And then that worked pretty well, right, with the tribal leaders cracking down and marginalizing Al-Qaeda in Iraq almost right out of existence, you might have thought.
Right. So the American policy of working with the Sunni tribal warlords was mutually beneficial for both sides. So the United States had a huge PR disaster in the United States where it was simply just losing way too many troops. Iraq was out of control. Too many people were dying. And, you know, I mean, even one life is too much, especially with a war like Iraq, which was, you know, founded on a pretext and a preamble of lies, really. But the Iraqi tribal leaders really also had a problem that their lower members were attacking them now. They were joining up with Al-Qaeda. They were joining up with all these other groups. And they started to attack these tribal leaders themselves. And they had this huge problem on their hands where their own rule was beginning to spiral out of control. So the United States comes along and says, we'll give you guys money. We'll pay you guys, you know, we'll pay you and all your men X amount of dollars every month. We'll arm you. And really, this awakening movement is really what spelled the end for the Iraqi state, ironically. So the United States thought that by arming the Sunnis, they would end up with a safer Iraq, but that did not turn out to be the case. So while these awakening militias were loyal to the United States, and as you said, they led to a huge reduction in violence, what this really did by arming these militias is they undermined the central authority of the Iraqi government and the Iraqi military. So that's really why the Iraqi military has no authority over much of the Sunni areas of Iraq today.
Yeah, they never really did integrate them. They were just being paid. And then because America, not just because of the invasion and the overthrow of Saddam, but because America stayed and helped the Baada Brigade and the Mahdi Army kick all the Sunnis out of Baghdad, that gave Maliki and his Dawah Party buddies that much less reason to need to compromise with the Sunnis about anything. They got the crappiest part of Iraq. Let him bake in the sun, and what does he care? And so, as you said earlier, as soon as America left, Maliki quit paying them to even be the patrol in their own neighborhoods. And yet, see, this is maybe a little bit off topic from exactly where we're going on the Islamic State, but, you know, it always seemed to me like, I know this, it's always been the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution, the Dawah Party, and Iran's position that they don't really want the Sunni areas anyway. That's why they didn't just withdraw from Mosul this June. They withdrew from Mosul in great measure a year ago, last spring, and from Fallujah last December. It's not their territory to hold. Let them have the crappiest part of Iraq, ISIS, tribal, or otherwise, I think has been Maliki and Dawa's view. But anyway, now we got to go to break, but we'll be back more with Waleed Farwana in just a minute. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. darrenscoffee.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Talking with Waleed Farwana. He wrote this article, The History of the Islamic State, at antiwar.com. And where we left off, it was we're talking about in 2011, after America left without the Americans to pay the awakening movement, Maliki just left them high and dry, quit paying them, and then, you know, I guess you want to pick up from there. That's part of what's led to the crisis here, and you have a whole section in your article here, 2011. A lot of things happened in 2011, including America's withdrawal and stopping the payments to the Awakening Councils.
Right. So, as we said, like you said, the United States left the power vacuum and didn't really leave a stable government, didn't really leave really any semblance of a stable society. There was the war in Libya. There was the war in Syria. There was instability all over the region. And I think that things that were going on in Iraq were really sort of just like white noise in the background compared to like the Egyptian Revolution and the Syrian Civil War and the Libyan Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
And really like this myriad of conflicts that were all happening at once. So during this time, we talked about this earlier, but the arming of these Sunni militias really almost led to the eradication of Al-Qaeda in Iraq and other groups like it. But what happened was the destabilization in Syria opened the door for gave them breathing room, essentially. They took out, really what happened was Bashar al-Assad's regime was destabilized. It could no longer essentially defend its eastern border. And this is where Al-Qaeda in Iraq migrated west to Syria and began to establish its bases there. And if we look at it today, that's where their base is. Their base is right there in Syria, right at the, really right at the heart, in the Sunni heartland between the Iraq and Syria borders.
Yeah, and you know what? I had this short clip. It's not too long, but I think this really just makes the point so well. It's from the beginning of 2012. Phil Giraldi reported that a new finding had been signed by Obama at the end of 2011, ramping up covert activity in Iran and Syria. And they were being criticized for not doing enough. And so in this question, Hillary is on the defensive. How come you're not doing enough to help the rebels overthrow Assad? And this was her answer.
We know Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria? Hamas is now supporting the opposition. Are we supporting Hamas in Syria?
All right. Now, so the Hamas thing is obviously kind of a red herring. But the point being, and she's not saying to back any rebels at all is to directly put arms in the hands of bin Ladenites. She's saying to intervene on the side of a rebellion that Al-Qaeda has also endorsed is a dangerous thing, just in the broadest sense. And she, in her own words, she equates it to, are we backing them if we are intervening in this war on the same side as them? And the answer, of course, is yes. And then, of course, she has worked the hardest to maintain her reputation as the one who pushed for that exact same policy the hardest after saying that, after admitting that that was exactly the case. That if there was one, just like in Libya, if there was one anti-Al-Qaeda force in the country you could count on, it was the local clean-shaven, chin-having secular dictator with the military uniform on, or the pinstripe suit, as opposed to the robes and the whole Osama getup here.
Yeah, I mean, but they I mean, flip-flopping politician, I mean, whoa. Not like we've ever heard of that before. But
it's crazy.
I
mean, when she announces that, listen, this policy would amount to treason, and then she, I mean, that's not the average flip-flop. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, it's absurd. And it's just what I've come to really expect, and I think a lot of Americans have come to expect at this point from the Obama administration and the U.S. government as a whole, especially after the war in Iraq and the economic crisis that we had in 2008. At the same time, supporting Assad is, I think, for U.S. interests, more dangerous than for them to support the Syrian rebels. And the reason for that is Assad is really a client of the Iranians. And at least throughout the 2000s, Iran was really looked at as the most powerful enemy of the United States in the region. And working with Assad would mean working with Iran, which would mean alienating, the greatest ally the United States has, and I say that sarcastically, Israel. And the Israelis don't want that. And because the Israelis don't want that, neither do the Saudi Arabians, they won't work with Assad. They will work instead with really whoever they can get their hands on. And they're looking for, they're out there, they're grasping for potential allies in Syria, but there really are none. There is really just, there's the Free Syrian Army, who are clients of Qatar and Turkey to some extent. But they are pretty much a weak and almost defeated force, in my opinion. So there's really no, there's really nobody for the United States to latch on to there.
Yeah, I agree with that. As we were talking about earlier on the show, Michael Scheuer, who of course doesn't care at all about what Israel wants in Syria, his only point of view is what's best for the American people on this. And he says to ally with Assad now, just as you said, because they're clients of Iran, in his case, his specific objection was it's going to rally that many more people to ISIS's cause. For America intervening that much more on the side of the Shiites. In fact, really, I mean, to the degree they helped them take Baghdad before, that's one thing. But right now, because the American troops aren't on the ground there, it's the Iranian Quds forces filling in that space. And so you would have America outright backing Iran, not just de facto doing Iran's dirty work in Iraq from the fall of Saddam on, but outright flying their air cover, being their air force, and generating that whole giant backlash that who knows what kind of further consequences could flow from that. So, yeah, backing Assad is almost as bad as backing the rebels against him, in a sense.
Yeah, and there's one other thing I should have mentioned, but which I forgot to, which was we have to look at the Saudi role. So the Saudi Arabians are locked in this very heated regional struggle with the Iranians. And if the United States did support Assad in Syria, they would probably end up seeing a full-scale schism between themselves. between themselves and the Saudi Arabians, which is something the U.S. does not want to do, particularly because of its obvious power as an oil-producing state, and because they've given them so many resources in the past 10 to 20 years that it would be kind of insane for them to go back on their agreements with the Saudis. Mm-hmm. So that's another huge reason they don't want to alienate Saudi Arabia and or Israel, for that matter. And yeah, I think it does come at the expense of American interests, the interests of the American people. But unfortunately, I don't think that these empire building games are really done with the interests of the average guy on the street. They're just more about the adventurism of politicians and lining the pockets of investors.
Yep. All right. Now, so we got very little time left, but we have Obama's announced strategy of continuing to back, supposedly build up this third force in Syria, whatever phantoms and jihadists that he wants to arm up there and team up with the Kurds and the Shiite militias and the Iraqi army in Iraq. Do you think that any and all of those groups combined, does anybody have the ability to actually dislodge these guys from Raqqa or Mosul without sending in the U.S. Army?
I don't know. See, it's really difficult to say when it comes to war. I mean, you saw that it was pretty successful in dislodging Gaddafi's army from Libya.
Yeah, with air power and special forces. Yeah, that's true.
Right, but ISIS is not a military. It's a militia.
Right. And yeah, they can turn really back into an insurgency just by snapping their fingers. They can go from state right back again.
Exactly. Yeah. And I saw a really good quote recently by Nassim Nicholas Taleb, where he compared ISIS to a tech startup versus a corporation. And ISIS is like a startup, and an army is like a corporation. And really, you need a militia. You need a startup to fight a startup. And whether or not these particular militias have the grit to take out ISIS, I really don't know.
Send in the PKK. All right, we got to go. Thanks so much for your time. Appreciate it. That's Waleed Farwana, everybody. The History of the Islamic State at antiwar.com. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me on.
Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. Phil Giraldi is going to be on the show later. And I'll tell you exactly what he's going to say. He's going to say, it's crazy. I can't understand it. I know that's what he's going to say. He's one of these guys. He understands the issue well enough that it makes his brain explode on a daily basis. What in the world? This policy makes no sense. No. Not that I don't get it. I get it. It just doesn't make sense. And I see, you know, even the different interests in making it what it is, but it still makes no sense. And for example, I've been promising, I'm finally going to get to it here. Adam, if you hear this part of the show later, please tack this on to the end of our last guest interview here. Where the hell is it? I Googled it earlier. All right, I lost it. Now I got to Google it all over again. Here it is. It's right here. This is Michael Oren. Now, he's saying this just a few weeks ago when he has no longer been the Israeli ambassador to the United States for half a year or so. Okay, so, and he does say, you can hear his disclaimer, I'm not speaking for the Israeli government, I'm just speaking for myself. But then over and over again he says, so, from the Israeli government's point of view, this is what we want to see. And, you know, that's where he's actually being honest. He's speaking for Netanyahu and their government and their policy and our government's policy because it's their government's policy these last 3 years. And it sounds crazy on the face of it. And that's why Jeffrey Goldberg kind of scoots his chair back and says, oh, geez, I don't know, pal, about this. But you should know that he said this as he was still in transition as the outgoing ambassador last October. The article, well, this is the Haaretz version, but there's, no, the original was in the Jerusalem Post. Hang on, let me add the Jerusalem Post so I get it just right for you. I like doing footnotes, man. It's important you get your footnotes right. He told the Jerusalem Post, come on, Google, I said, where is it? Oh, come on, guys. All right, well, fine. I'll settle for the Haaretz version then. Ambassador Oren, Israel has wanted Assad ousted since the Syria war began. In an interview with the Jerusalem Post, Israel's envoy to the United States, still currently serving at the time, says Jerusalem prefers bad guys who aren't backed by Iran. Adds that Assad's overthrow could also weaken Hezbollah. And so there you go. That was what he said. And the initial message, this is a direct quote from Oren, the initial message about the Syrian issue was that we always wanted Bashar Assad to go. We always preferred the bad guys who weren't backed by Iran to the bad guys who were backed by Iran. In this case, being Al-Qaeda. in a war between Assad and Hezbollah and Iran versus Al-Qaeda, Israel preferred Al-Qaeda. That was what he said when he was still the ambassador of the United States. Here he is elaborating on video. You can hear him in his own words, Ambassador Michael Oren, former Ambassador Michael Oren, with Jeffrey Goldberg at the Aspen Ideas Festival.
If stay in there for another couple more weeks, what do you think your country is doing in order to protect your interests, and how are you working to align with other partners?
All right, remember, keep in mind, I don't speak for the government anymore. I'm speaking for me and Jeff.
No, you're not.
And what I'm going to say is harsh, perhaps a little edgy. But if we have to choose the lesser of evils here, the lesser evil is the Sunnis over the Shiites. For the reason
you're
I
not speaking
before.
For me.
Okay, it's a lesser evil. It's an evil, believe me, it's a terrible evil. Again, they've just taken out 1,700 former Iraqi soldiers and shot them in a field. But who are they fighting against? They're fighting against the proxy with Iran that's complicit in the murder of 160,000 people in Syria. You can just, you know, do the math. And again, one side is armed with suicide bombers and rockets. The other side has access to military nuclear capabilities. So from Israel's perspective, if there's got to be an evil that's going to prevail, you know, let the Sunni evil prevail. And I'm speaking entirely for myself. As the Sykes-Picot system breaks down, Israel has got to guard its borders. We have built a high-tech fence very quickly along our Egyptian border. We're building a high-tech fence along our Syrian border. We have a primary interest in maintaining the stability of Jordan. Our security border is not the Jordanian-Israeli border. It's the Jordanian-Iraqi border. Jordan, among other things, is what keeps that mess out of our backyards. And we'll be working to shore up Jordan. And I know when I was in Washington...
Anyway, so... point being, there you have it. He specifically identifies them, too. Who is it he's talking about? Is he talking about the moderate rebels? No. They've got the suicide bombers on that side. And then on the other side, they've got rockets and access to nuclear capability. Yeah, right. Rockets, he means Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. And no, Iran is not making nuclear weapons. They never were. And if they ever were, they would have 100 by now. It's 2014 and a half plus now. It's the future. And the reason they don't have any is because they never were making them this whole time. So even when he's being honest, it's not like you can't, it's not like you can rely on somebody like this to actually be honest about the facts. But at least he's being honest about Israel's policy and therefore Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama's policy since 2011. And I'll say it again, I've said it a million times, I can't figure out for the life of me how these kooks think that even a boiling cauldron of suicide bomber chaos on their northern border is better than Assad, who uses his entire state army to keep his own people at bay. For them, basically, he might as well be their guy. He hasn't done a thing about the Golan Heights the entire time he's been in power. Oh, you stole it, huh? Okay, fine, is basically his answer to that. And his support for Hezbollah is nil, and his assassination of Rafik Hariri never happened. That was a frame-up job. And then when they told him, get your army the hell out of southern Lebanon, he did. The fact that that only benefited Hezbollah, well, you're stupid then for blaming an assassination on Syria and forcing their secular army out, if that's your problem. But you see here how there's daylight between Israeli foreign policy and American foreign policy. And American foreign policy instead goes along. There is no daylight, really. There's a daylight in our interests. There is no daylight in our foreign policy. That's the problem I'm meaning to highlight for you here. And, you know, the boiling cauldron doctrine, there's a lot to that. I mean, Wolfgang in the chat room is saying, hey, look, man, Michael Ledeen forever called it the boiling cauldron. Let's be revolutionaries. In fact, I have a clip of Michael Ledeen saying, why do they call us conservatives? I don't know. We're not conservatives. We're revolutionaries. Yeah, we know. They just want to overturn everything, expedite the chaotic collapse, as David Wormser put it, in about referring to Syria in his study Coping with Crumbling States. And there's the Yanan plan going back to the 80s. And the clean break doesn't really say we want chaos. They want order along, you know, their newly drawn lines and whatever. I tend to think, and really, if you look at the policy in the Iraq war, look at it right now. They're doing everything they can to get the Kurds to stick with Baghdad as long as possible. Netanyahu is saying, secede! And the Americans are saying, no, don't. Well, yeah, so the Israelis, they may want their boiling cauldron. I think the boiling cauldron that exists there now is because of America doing what the Israelis want mostly, and that includes with the invasion of Iraq. But the Americans, I don't think, have been trying to do like Michael Ledeen and create all this chaos. They just can't help it. Once you accept the premises of Ariel Sharon foreign policy, well, then this is what happens. Just weeks before the war, Bush said, what's a Shiite? He had no idea at all. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I guess I can divide this segment in half here real quick. I do want to elaborate about the Israeli role in American foreign policy since September 11th. Michael M.J. Rosenberg just tweeted out this New York Times article from September 12th when Netanyahu was asked what the attack meant. Oh, asked tonight, meaning this was written on the 11th. Oh, asked tonight what the attack meant for relations between the United States and Israel. Benjamin Netanyahu, the former prime minister, replied, "It's very good." Then he edited himself. "Well, not very good, but it will generate immediate sympathy." He predicted that the attack would, quote, "strengthen the bond between our two peoples, because we've experienced terror over so many decades, but the United States has now experienced a massive hemorrhaging of terror." A hemorrhaging of terror. I don't know what he's talking about. And then in an appearance late tonight, Prime Minister Ariel Sharon repeatedly placed Israel on the same ground as the United States, blah, blah, blah. Counting on the fact, as Netanyahu, now their current prime minister, again, has said before on tape, the Americans are easily moved. It's absurd. So we'll just tell them what to think, which is your enemies are our enemies. And it doesn't matter that Hamas is not Al-Qaeda, and Al-Qaeda hates Hamas. It doesn't matter that Hezbollah is not Al-Qaeda. Hezbollah is the exact opposite of Al-Qaeda. Okay? It doesn't matter any of these things. All that matters is you hate and fear Arabs and Muslims more. Great. There's another quote of Netanyahu years later repeating, saying the same thing. He can't help himself, saying, "We are benefiting from the attack on the World Trade Center towers and the American struggle in Iraq." Right? He can't even just say we're benefiting from the war in Iraq or whatever. What is it about the war in Iraq that you're benefiting from, Benjamin Netanyahu? The American struggle there, he says. Americans getting sniped, getting shot, getting bombed, getting killed, getting maimed by Arabs is good for Israeli public relations in the United States. Easily moved. Absurd. The American people are, to Benjamin Netanyahu, his direct words. And so that became their mission. To conflate all of their enemies with ours. And yes, they cooperated fully with lying the American people into war with Iraq. And I think that they're stupid, just like with pushing regime change in Syria these last 3 years and before. I think they're crazy. You can read Julian Borger in The Guardian, "The Spies Who Pushed for War." You type in that in, "The Spies Who Pushed for War." They're not spies at all, but British headlines always suck. It's not Borger's fault, but it's the neocons who push for war. That's what it's about, the neoconservatives. The spies who push for war is the title. And then there, unless maybe there he's referring to Mossad. And then there's Agents of Influence by Robert Dreyfuss in The Nation is also a really good one. And James Bamford in his book, A Pretext for War, 9/11 Iraq and the Abuse of America's Intelligence Agencies, he writes about this as well, that in Ariel Sharon's government, they created an Office of Special Plans over there to manufacture intelligence in English to stick straight into the stovepipe, as they called it, of bogus intelligence running through the Pentagon into the vice president's office and into George Bush's office without having to go through the CIA. And or anybody else, the Bureau of Intelligence and Research at State or whatever. That's how they got the Niger uranium forgeries in the State of the Union address, for example. But anyway, so that stovepipe. So anyway, yeah, the Israelis and of course, Mearsheimer and Walt famously wrote at length about all that the American-Israel lobby did to promote war with Iraq back in 2002 and 3, and you can also read there's a webpage somewhere, American Rhetoric, and it's all American flags, and it's still very much in the spirit of September 13th, you know, and it has a very like tough guy looking picture of Netanyahu above the transcript of his speech that he gave. I think you might be able to find the video of this, too. When he came to the United States, I think the week of, maybe it was the next week after September. No, I think he came the week of and was on TV. But then he gave the speech to Congress the next week, something like that. But you can see how the Israelis have constantly been agitating for America to go after Iraq. And then when it turned out that they were suckers who believed Ahmed Chalabi, who was actually working for Iran, and that they were going to be the prime beneficiaries of the war, you know, other than Osama and his guys, then they're the ones who pushed this redirection policy and said America must ally with the Sunni jihadis against the Shia, starting back in 2007 and 8. Which is the policy that George Bush turned around and his big pivot and did. Biddle's pivot, that's what Just Raimondo called it in an article, because Biddle was the academic who wrote it all up for Foreign Affairs about why it needed to be done. And then only now are we redirecting back again toward the Iranians because of the Sunni monster that they've created. Despite what Michael Oren wants, the prospect of an Islamic State truly run by a bin Ladenite clone like this guy Baghdadi now is intolerable for American politics. And so they pushed it too far, and now America has to go and redirect back the way again. But anyway, it's just, well, it's madness. It's madness that they get away with this and that everybody who helped them get away with this is failed to be held accountable this whole time, and so they all just continue. Man. And now, see, I'm out of time. I wanted to really make the case against going. Well, here's the case. America can only distort power over there and can only screw up and make matters worse. And ISIS is actually pretty weak, despite how brutal they are, and they're surrounded by enemies with far more men than them. And as long as America does the heavy lifting, everybody else is going to sit back. And so America should do nothing, and it should be on the Iraqi government, an army that the U.S. gave them, the Shia militias, the Iranians, the Kurdish, Peshmerga, and PKK commies, Bashar al-Assad, the king of Jordan, and the king of Saudi, whoever, whatever, his mercs that he hires, whatever. It's their problem. Let them fix it. The fact that I can just rattle off, what, how many was that? 6-7 different enemies that ISIS is surrounded by right now is, oh, and also they're ruling over a bunch of Sunni tribesmen who don't really like them. And they're making themselves quite unwelcome with their totalitarianism as well. And so, all America can do by intervening there is make matters worse. There, that only took me 45 seconds, right? As simple as that. America created this mess. Quit making it worse. All right, Phil Giraldi. Up next. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm on the Liberty Radio Network, LRN.FM and ScottHorton.org and Twitter/ScottHortonShow and all that. All right. Phil Giraldi, he's a former CIA guy and then also is the executive director of the Council for the National Interest at CouncilForTheNationalInterest.org, and he writes for the American Conservative and UNS.com. Welcome back to the show, Phil. How are you doing? Oh, I hit the wrong dang button. Welcome back to the show, Phil. How are you doing?
I'm fine, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing all right, except I never can keep track of whether my guests are on Skype or on the phone or which button is which. But anyway, these things happen frequently. So, did you see Obama's big speech last night?
No.
Did you read about it?
Practice. Yeah, of course I did. I don't, you know, I would have been throwing things at the television set if I had watched it.
I didn't watch it either.
So I decided just to read the text afterwards, and that was enough.
All right, well, so what'd you think? You know, he said the other day, last week, he didn't have a strategy, but they've been working really hard on it, and now they've got one, so.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, the thing that disturbs me about it, and I haven't seen much commentary on it in the media this morning, even in the places where I would have expected to see something, is that he basically has declared war on Syria, a country with which we are not at war, and essentially he's doing it without the consent of Congress, and intends to keep doing it as long as it takes to accomplish whatever he thinks has to be accomplished.
Yeah. Well, okay, so let's go ahead and stick with that issue for a minute. Obviously, it's a huge one. So I guess, as our previous guest was explaining, because of Israel and because of Saudi Arabia, they just will not tolerate America tilting back to Assad like they did during Clinton and Bush Jr. years. Having him torture and kill Al-Qaeda guys for us. And so they're stuck to this third way position where supposedly they're going to build up this army of moderates that, you know, I guess the FSA, however moderate or not, to be this third force that's supposed to be able to take on Nusra, ISIS, and Assad because they just can't tilt back to Assad. And yet, meanwhile, you know, Patrick Coburn was reporting that he had sources telling him that the U.S. was passing intelligence to Assad through the Germans to help him target ISIS, because, of course, he's the one with the state army around there who could actually hurt them. But so, you know, what a mess. Make sense of this for me.
Well, I mean, you can't make sense of it. That's what I say. I mean, because, you know, apart from arming these clowns, and didn't he say a couple months ago that the whole concept of the moderate revolutionaries in Syria was basically a fraud?
Yeah, a fantasy was his term. So, yeah, even worse than a fraud.
So he said that, and now all of a sudden he's going to be arming them. Where is he going to find them? And then, of course, the corollary to all this, why I say he's declared war on Syria, is because we're going to be bombing in Syria. And he said that we're going to be, you know, using our planes and our bombs and everything to attack allegedly terrorist targets in Syria. But, you know, it's Syrian sovereign territory. We're not at war with them. And you know, it's just these things get crazier and crazier. And you just kind of you try to figure out what are these people thinking of? Mm-hmm. And now we have an open commitment to destroy this terrorist group. That's the word he's using, and we're basically going to be pulling together all these alleged allies. It's going to be a repeat of Iraq with the coalition of the willing. Is Turkey going to allow us to use bases to bomb Syria? If that's not the case, where are we going to put our airplanes? If they fly them up from the Persian Gulf, it's going to take. It's, you know, by the time they get there, they have to turn around and come back. You see what I'm saying? It's just that this whole thing is so stupid that you have to wonder if the Marx Brothers actually are running the White House.
Yeah, exactly. I think there was even an article like that at UNS where it was from a Marxist perspective, but he meant, I forget which Marx Brother it was. It says, who are you going to believe, me or your own lying eyes?
Yeah, it was Chico, yeah.
Yeah, right. Yeah, there you go. I mean, the thing of it is, I guess if they're passing intelligence to Assad, can we assume then that there really has been a turn in the policy and that they know that Assad is the only game in town on this, and now they have to switch back to him, and that they will have at least his covert permission to bomb in a Pakistan model kind of a way? It seems like that's what they're looking at. Although, you know, they told the AP, oh, yeah, no, but we hate Assad so much that we're considering bombing regime targets at the same time to make sure that we don't accidentally give Assad the advantage.
Yeah, I saw that. I mean, when you talk about idiotic comments, I mean, that's got to be number one. I don't know if they cut any deals with Assad. I think that it would be dangerous for them to do that because obviously they've made such strong statements against any cooperation with him. That's, I suspect that if he did that, if the administration did that, and it came out, the Republicans would run with that all the way to getting, you know, elected in 2016. I can't see that he cut that kind of deal. He might be cutting a deal through an intermediary like the Germans. That's possible. But at the same time, I think that what we're seeing here is a total disconnect to the policy. And I think you and I have talked about this before, because you look at, you know, the whole game going back and forth on who the U.S. is supporting in Syria and Iraq has been senseless right from the beginning.
Yeah, sorry, low-flying plane. I was trying to leave it out as much as I could there. It seems like, and people say this all the time, and there's good reason to believe it, I guess, a lot of times, or you could certainly see why people believe that the policy must be a grand design, a perfect plot to create a perfect storm, because just look how horrible this is. You couldn't have had the worst war propagandist come up with the current situation. If they had to, you know?
Yeah. If you had tried to engineer this situation as screwed up as this, you wouldn't be able to do it. But you know, it just seems like a bad decision after bad decision after bad decision. And one of the interesting things about this is, of course, this focus on ISIS means that, you know, other things that are getting screwed up are being kind of ignored. They're falling out of the news. Like I was doing some updating on Ukraine and everything this morning, and that situation, which is far more dangerous in terms of United States interests, is just kind of flying under the screen right now in terms of how the Hegel a few days ago said that, we're going to be bringing Georgia into NATO, and we're going to accelerate the process. And what's her face, Nuland, Victoria Nuland, has indicated that we're supporting the Moldova against the Russians, and we're going to be sending weapons to the Ukrainians. And you know, all this stuff is crazy. It's crazy stuff. And unfortunately, right now, because everybody's talking about ISIS, it's just kind of going along under its own power.
And when you say Moldova, that's an And, you know, I don't know, we can get back to Iraq in a minute, but when you say Moldova, that's where you have the Transdniester little strip of land next to the river there, where they're loyal to Russia first, and there's been the worry that they would go back under Russian sovereignty somehow.
Yeah, that's right.
And you're
right.
Saying Nuland is saying over our dead body.
And Nuland, in fact, in her, if you look it up, this was testimony before a Senate committee back a couple months ago, and what she was referring to Moldova and Georgia as frontline states. You know, these are frontline states against Russia, and obviously she is designating what the front line is. The front line is where we are confronting Russia. And this is scary kind of language, apart from anything else, in terms of how your head is working to rationalize what's going on in the place. And it just I'm at a total loss to determine what the logic of this process is. Where are the U.S. interests that are being served in this?
Yeah. Well, and boy, I don't know who allowed how in the world. I guess maybe it was a Hillary thing. How Victoria Nuland even got that job. Obama. Well, no, I guess Obama's a big fan of Robert Kagan, right? He was carrying around his book back when he was running for re-election.
Mm-hmm.
About,
that's right.
Never mind the post-American world. It's time to reinstate the empire with brand new vigor. So I guess it all makes sense there. All right, hold the line. We'll be right back, y'all, with Phil Giraldi from UNS.com and the American Conservative Magazine. This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Phil Giraldi. He writes for the American Conservative Magazine and UNS.com. And we're talking about Obama's newest declaration of war against the Islamic State. And, of course, the proxy war that is right now at ceasefire in Ukraine and the consequences. I actually had missed it. There's so much going on, Phil. I did not realize that Chuck Hagel had said that, yes, we are moving forward again on bringing Georgia into NATO. I knew that, well, I guess last I heard, they had sort of called that off for Ukraine for now, even though, like you said, they still want to give them weapons. And then they even had announced some training exercises they want to do in Ukraine right in the middle of a war or right after one. I don't know.
I mean, he said in light of the, you know, the Russia's blatant aggression, that they would be moving quickly to expand NATO by including Georgia. I mean, this is just insane talk.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was talking with Jack Matlock, the second to last ambassador to the Soviet Union, on the show last week, and I was saying, well, isn't it the case? Because he was just livid. I mean, he was out of his mind about this. And I says, well, you know, the case is that if we bring these countries into NATO, then that means, hey, they're protected by the American Empire now. They're under our umbrella, and Russia can never do anything about it again. It's peace. It's, you know, global hegemony by the American Empire is what prevents these conflicts from breaking out. And, He seemed to think that you got it wrong. Ukraine is a red line. They've said it 10,000 times, and they'll say it again, and they'll say it with nukes if they have to, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's depressing, yeah.
But I don't know. I guess at the Georgetown cocktail party circuit or whatever, that's where these policies are decided, right? And all cool people there know that this is what to do. Is that what it comes down to, or what is this?
I guess that's what it is. I think you and I have discussed in the past that there clearly is a Washington elite consensus on foreign policy, and it has nothing to do with the political parties necessarily, although it incorporates elements in them. It has a lot more to do with this whole sense of what we are as a country and what our imperatives and everything are. And this is where a lot of this dangerous nonsense comes out of. These people, as you point out, are cocktail party circuit, experts on everything. And as a result, they basically see things in terms of their own privilege, in terms of their own hegemony, in terms of our political system. And it's dangerous. I mean, it's beyond dangerous. If they really want to play games with Russia, they're asking for trouble. And we don't need it. There is no reason for any of this.
Yeah. Well, you know, Robert Perry had a theory that a big part of what's going on in Ukraine and why Victoria Nuland et al. Are so interested in provoking a crisis there was to try to drive a wedge between Obama and Putin, who've been getting along on which issues? Iran and Syria. And you know, Israel's biggest priorities.
Yeah, well, I mean, it could be. I mean, certainly, Obama, who is not, to whatever else you want to accuse him of, he's not a dumb guy, and unlike his predecessor. And he really must understand these issues. But the fact is, he's also a political animal, and he's obviously under pressure from a lot of different constituencies. And in my judgment, what he's not doing, he's not showing any leadership. And all he does is he's doing sort of an ad hoc performance in responding to various pressure groups. And, yeah, sure, there are a lot of people out there who have really no interest in peace for this country or a lack of involvement in other people's quarrels. It seems that I was just reading a review by Hillary Clinton, of all people, of Kissinger's new book. Mm-hmm. And she basically buys whole the argument that the United States has a leadership role to give, to provide justice and freedom in the world. I mean, this is ridiculous. Nobody outside the Beltway actually thinks the United States has anything to do with justice and liberty.
Yeah. Well, in fact, if anything, it's a great benefit that it's Henry Kissinger writing that, because we all know he doesn't give a damn about justice or liberty. He's Henry Kissinger, for crying out loud. He's the poster boy for letting little kids bleed. So, you know, we know what he means by that is hegemony dressed up in this PR nonsense.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what it is. And in fact, I'm writing an article on it. I'm basically saying that Hillary doesn't know the difference between leadership and hegemony, or leadership and dominance, because that's the way she thinks, and we need a change in the way they think.
Yeah. Well, now, so back to the what I think is just an insane policy. I mean, we really talked about the Syria half of the insanity here, of the way that they're going back to war with ISIS now. But the other part of it is they've replaced Maliki with a carbon copy from the same party. Roy Gutman says this guy's a little bit more sophisticated and maybe not as partisan as Maliki, but he's from the Dawah party. And it seems like even just throwing in with the Iraqi government at all at this point is aligning with Iran to a degree, even beyond what Bush did. Because Bush was de facto fighting for Iran, but the Iranians weren't really there. When they were there, they were mostly fighting against America, or when they were like helping Sadr fight the Americans kind of thing. But now we're going to outright be their air force, and that seems like it's going to really blow up right in our face. I even saw, I forget if you and I talked about this before, but I saw Michael Scheuer, who we all know doesn't give a damn about what Israel wants, saying that no, we still shouldn't back Assad, because backing Assad, only just like backing Iran or even backing the Baghdad government in this situation, puts us on the side of the Shiites in this sectarian war that we got started, but it just makes matters that much worse, no matter which side we take in this thing. And so I wonder what you think about that.
Well, I don't know. I don't think the problem is, I think it's jargon here. It's not a question of who we're backing. I think it's a question of playing off various interests in a way that you're not seen as adversarial. Because the fact is, if you want to crush ISIS, it's not a problem. ISIS, it has a bunch of neighbors who would like to get rid of it, and you basically have to, you know, signal to them that, hey, we support, you know, your armed forces and going after these people and so on and so forth. We're not going to get involved, but at the same time, we support what you're doing. And you leave it there. I mean, if you take all the armed forces in Syria, Iraq, Turkey, and Iran, put them together, they outnumber the ISIS people by about 500-1.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's not really an insurmountable problem.
Well, it seems like it's one that we don't even really need to be involved in at all. If all of these groups hate ISIS so much, then...
Exactly. So we don't have to be on anyone's side. I think that's kind of a misperception.
Yeah. So then if I really have my way, and that was it, we just didn't do a damn thing at all, and just go ahead and let Muqtada al-Sadr deal with it, or whoever, the local Sunni tribesmen who are the ones being taken over here, is that really, you think, the most workable plan?
Well, we haven't been presented with any workable plans. That's the problem.
So mine is the best one.
Sorry?
So mine is the best one.
Yeah, it probably is. because we haven't been presented with anything, and we haven't been presented, as the same thing with the situation in Ukraine and everything, with any credible intelligence on any of this stuff. Right. Have you noticed that? I mean, there's nothing coming out of any of this that you would consider credible.
Yeah, I mean, all of that is the dog that didn't bark, big time, especially about the shoot down of the plane and all of what's been going on in Ukraine this whole time. All the evidence they've never come up with for all the claims they've
made. That's right. That's right. Weeks, and we've had no evidence on anything that you or I would go to the bank on. You know, it's amazing that they're getting away with all this stuff. And I expected last night that he would put out some, you know, phony intelligence type stuff. He didn't even bother. I mean, it's just that, oh yeah, we have these guys, they're really threatening us. This morning he had his director of Homeland Security, his poodle, on, you know, talking about, oh, well, you know, yeah, these guys are threatening us. And there's some guys trying to get over there to join them. And boy, we're watching them closely. And we've caught two of them. You know, we've caught two of them.
Yep, and this is the only place where I agree with the war propaganda a little bit, is I'm paranoid about these guys because I think they do have motive to attack us, to drag us into the mess because it's good for their PR. And also, I have absolutely zero faith whatsoever in any national police or intelligence agencies to keep these guys out of the country if they do try to come here. And all it takes, it takes two beheading videos from far away. Imagine if one guy took one rifle to a mall or whatever in the name of jihad. That'd be, as big, might as well be September 11th. You know, just that. Crap, we're out of time. Thanks, Phil. Talk to you soon.
Okay, Scott.
Phil Giraldi, everybody. He's at the American Conservative. See you tomorrow.